Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary have been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we are taking a really fascinating and often quite terrifying look into Barbara W. Tuchman's Pulitzer Prize-winning history, The Guns of August.
It really is a foundational piece of history. And Tuchman's focus is surgically precise, isn't it?
Yeah.
She looks right at that first crucial month of World War I, August 1914.
Right.
And she argues that this specific 30-day period, well, it was the hinge point, the moment that really set the disastrous course for the whole 20th century.
And what we're trying to unpack for you today is Tuchman's central puzzle. How did a crisis that seemed maybe containable, you know, the assassination of an archduke way off in the Balkans, mm-hmm. how did that spiral so quickly into a global catastrophe, mm-hmm. a war that killed millions and just shattered the old European order? And what really stands out in Tuchman's work, I think, is her insistence that this war wasn't just some random accident, nor was it somehow inevitable, you know, like destiny.
Yeah.
No, she says it was the direct result of specific human choices. Often avoidable choices, flawed military plans, disastrous miscalculations made by powerful people under just, well, insane amounts of pressure.
So it's a tragedy, but one born out of flawed logic, not fate.
Exactly. A tragedy of errors, you could say. Now, before we really plunge into the military plans and mobilization chaos, we should probably talk a bit about the author guiding us through this. Barbara Wertheim Tuchman,
right.
1912 to 1989. She was quite a remarkable figure. It came from a prominent New York family, studied history and literature at Radcliffe, but she actually started out as a journalist.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, she even covered the Spanish Civil War on the ground.
You could really feel that journalistic background in her writing, can't you? She wasn't a professional academic historian in the traditional sense. She was self-taught. But she was absolutely meticulous with research, digging into primary sources. Mm. And she clearly prioritized, you know, narrative clarity,
yeah.
human drama,
no.
not dry academic jargon.
Absolutely. That's why her books are so incredibly readable, so immediate. Her unique angle was this focus on individual agency.
Meaning?
Well, instead of just focusing on, say, huge economic trends or vast social forces, Tuchman zooms in on the personalities, the psychology, the fears, the follies of the key players, the Kaisers, the generals, the politicians. She really wanted to show how history is moved not by these sort of impersonal tides, but by the specific decisions of specific, often very flawed human beings.
She definitely brings those historical figures to life. You feel their dilemmas, their pressures, which must be why the book had such an impact when it came out. It felt less like distant history and more like, I don't know, a high-stakes thriller unfolding in real time.
That's a great way to put it.
So all this kind of groundwork she lays, it leads us to the book's core argument, right? Tuchman basically argues that this catastrophic failure, World War I, it emerged from a collision.
A collision between what?
Between decades of really rigid, detailed human planning on one side and the messy, unpredictable reality of the battlefield on the other.
That's it, exactly. The whole point of the Guns of August is to show how every major European power's carefully crafted military and diplomatic plans just spectacularly collapsed within that first month.
And the key mechanism driving this collapse
is what Tuchman brilliantly calls the tyranny of the plan.
The tyranny of the plan. That sounds ominous, like a logistical nightmare taking over.
It was. These incredibly rigid, timetable-driven military strategies, especially Germany's Schlieffen Plan, they created this kind of mechanical momentum. It just steamrolled political considerations.
So once things got rolling, the politicians couldn't stop it.
Pretty much. Once those first mobilization orders went out, the political leaders, Kaisers, prime ministers, they effectively became prisoners of their own railway schedules. Wow.
They realized, maybe too late, that they couldn't just pause or de-escalate without risking what they perceive as a massive, immediate military disadvantage. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy of war.
So the book tracks this whole descent, right? From the Archduke's assassination in Sarajevo right up to the first huge clash at the Battle of the Marne.
Correct. And Tuchman's opening is just masterful storytelling. She starts with the 1910 funeral of Britain's King Edward VII.
Yes, I remember that part.
All the royalty of Europe is there, 9 reigning kings, all these potentates in their spectacular uniforms, cousins, many of them. And they're gathered in this incredible display of grandeur, completely unaware, Tuckman implies, that they're basically celebrating the final moments of their old interconnected world.
It's such a poignant, almost cinematic opening. So it's a really tragic tone.
It really does. So shall we dig into those plans, the ones that locked everyone in?
Let's do it. Starting with the big one, I assume. The German plan.
Absolutely. The Schlieffen plan. This is really the engine driving the start of the war on the Western Front. And it was a huge gamble, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A real all-or-nothing kind of strategy.
Totally. The idea was this massive scythe-like sweep. German armies would pivot through neutral Belgium, bypass the French border fortresses, encircle Paris from the northwest, and crush France within, what, 6 weeks?
6 weeks. That sounds incredibly ambitious.
It was. The assumption was they could knock France out fast before slow-moving Russia could fully mobilize its massive army in the east. Then they'd shift their forces eastwards.
But the plan had a massive, glaring flaw, didn't it? Belgium.
The fatal flaw. It was entirely political. To execute that sweep, they had to violate Belgian neutrality. And they knew, or certainly should have known, that invading Belgium would almost certainly bring Britain, the world's dominant naval power, into the war against them.
So they basically accepted making the war much bigger, maybe global, just to stick to this theoretically perfect military maneuver. That seems reckless.
Reckless is one word for it. It's like designing this incredibly complex project plan at work, you know? A waterfall plan where every step depends perfectly on the last. And the very first step involves, I don't know, demolishing the building next door without asking permission. The military logic, the perceived need for speed, completely overrode the political consequences.
Okay, so that's the German rigidity. What about the French? What was their grand plan?
Well, the French had Plan 7th, and it was quite different, almost the opposite in spirit.
How so?
It was driven by this philosophy called Elan, offensive spirit, fighting prowess, pure willpower almost. Their plan was for an immediate, headlong, all-out offensive straight into Alsace-Lorraine, the territories they'd lost to Germany in 1871.
So while the Germans were planning this huge flanking move through Belgium, the French were planning to charge straight ahead.
Pretty much, which was, well, tragically delusional in hindsight for two big reasons. First, it dangerously ignored intelligence suggesting the main German thrust might actually come through Belgium further north. And second, it fatally underestimated the power of modern defensive weapons.
Ah, the machine gun.
Exactly. Machine guns, rapid firing artillery. The French were essentially planning 19th century style charges, relying on bravery and spirit straight into the teeth of 20th century industrialized firepower. It was guaranteed slaughter.
So both sides had these grand plans that were deeply flawed, just in different ways.
Deeply flawed and incredibly rigid. And this brings us to that critical moment Tuckman describes where political control is just completely lost.
You mean when the Kaiser tried to stop it?
Yes. Tuckman recounts this almost frantic scene. Kaiser Wilhelm II, maybe finally grasping the abyss they were staring into, briefly considered halting the invasion of France, maybe just focus on Russia.
But his generals wouldn't let him.
His chief of staff, Helmut von Moltke the Younger, nephew of the famous Moltke, basically told him it was impossible. The mobilization timetables, the train schedules were too complex, too interlocked.
And that's where we get that chilling quote.
The deployment of millions cannot be improvised, Moltke insisted. The plan, the system, the schedule, it had taken over. Mobilization now meant war, automatically. There was no off-ramp left.
Wow. The tyranny of the plan, indeed.
And almost immediately, that mechanical commitment gets solidified by Britain's entry into the war.
Because of Belgium.
Precisely. King Albert III of Belgium made this incredibly courageous, maybe unexpected choice. He refused Germany's ultimatum demanding free passage for its troops. He chose resistance, despite knowing his small army faced overwhelming odds.
That stand must have had a huge impact.
Huge. That defiance, combined with reports of the German army's, frankly, brutal tactics as they invaded Belgium, the burning of Louvain, shooting civilians, it gave the British government the clear moral justification, the casus belli it needed.
Right, because there was opposition in Britain to getting involved, wasn't there?
There was significant division in the cabinet, but Belgium tipped the balance, Britain declared war on Germany, and the conflict truly became European-wide, soon to be global.
Meanwhile, things were also kicking off on the Eastern Front, right?
Yes, and faster than the Germans had banked on.
Mm-hmm.
Russia's mobilization, while chaotic and plagued by poor coordination, was surprisingly rapid.
Which messed with the Schlieffen plan.
Critically so. Even though the Russians suffered a catastrophic defeat early on at the Battle of Tannenberg, partly due to their generals' literally not coordinating with each other.
Seriously.
Yes, terrible command failures. But even so, their initial speed forced Moltke to pull two vital army corps from the right wing in France, the crucial hammer blow of the Schlieffen Plan, and send them east.
Weakening the main thrust against Paris.
Exactly. That seemingly small diversion, made under pressure, would prove absolutely devastating to German hopes just a few weeks later at the Marne.
And Tuchman also includes that amazing side story about the German warships, doesn't she? The Goeben.
Ah, yes, the Goeben and the Breslau. A fantastic example of how seemingly small events could have massive ripple effects. This German battlecruiser and its escort were in the Mediterranean when war broke out.
And the British Navy was hunting them.
Oh, yes, the whole Mediterranean fleet was after them. But through a combination of daring, speed, communication breakdowns on the British side, and frankly, some luck, they managed to evade the British patrols.
And where did they end up?
They steamed all the way to Constantinople, the capital of the neutral Ottoman Empire. They basically sailed into the harbor and were gifted to the Ottoman Navy, though still crewed by Germans.
And that tipped the Ottomans into the war.
It was a major factor. This dramatic arrival, this perceived German strength and audacity, helped sway the neutral Young Turk government to eventually join the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary.
Which had huge consequences, especially for Russia.
Absolutely catastrophic for Russia. Turkey joining the war meant they immediately closed the Dardanelles Strait, that narrow waterway connecting the Black Sea to the Mediterranean.
Cutting off Russia's main warm water port.
Exactly. It severed Russia's primary supply line to its Western allies, Britain and France. It isolated them. So a single daring naval escape dramatically widened the war and put Russia in a strategic bind that would contribute to its later collapse.
It's incredible how these different threads, Belgium, the Russian speed, the Goeben, all start interacting.
And they all converge, as Tuchman shows, on the most critical battle of the entire book, the First Battle of the Marne in early September 1914.
This is where the Schlieffen Plan finally runs into trouble.
Big trouble. The German armies, especially the crucial right wing, led by General Alexander von Kluck, were exhausted after weeks of marching and fighting. Supply lines were stretched thin. Communication with Moltke back at headquarters was breaking down.
And Kluck made a mistake.
A fatal one, according to Tuchman. He was aggressively pursuing the retreating French and British forces southwards. But instead of following the original plan, which called for sweeping west and south of Paris to encircle it, Kluck made this impulsive, aggressive turn east of Paris, heading southeast.
Why did he do that?
He thought the French were beaten and wanted to finish them off quickly, but by turning inwards towards the center, he dangerously exposed his army's right flank. The outer edge of the famous German scythe was suddenly vulnerable.
And someone noticed.
Someone did. General Joseph Joffre, the French commander-in-chief, he was known for his almost unnerving calm, his imperturbability, even under immense pressure. While others were panicking, Joffre kept his cool, synthesized the battlefield reports, and crucially, spotted Kluck's exposed flank.
And this is where the famous taxis come in.
This is it. General Gallieni, the military governor of Paris, realized the opportunity. He commandeered about 600 Parisian taxis Renault, mostly to rush thousands of reserve troops from the city garrison straight to the front line.
Wow, using taxis to fight a war.
It's an iconic image. These troops hit Kluck's exposed right flank hard in a surprise counterattack. Combined with renewed resistance from the main French and British forces along the Marne River, the German advance shuddered to a halt, literally within sight of the Eiffel Tower for some units.
So close.
Agonizingly close. Moltke, back at headquarters, receiving fragmented reports and apparently suffering a nervous breakdown from the stress, lost his nerve. He authorized a general withdrawal back to the Ahn River.
The Schlieffen Plan had failed.
Utterly. The gamble for a quick victory was lost. And Tuchman argues the Marne was decisive in a unique way. Not because it guaranteed an Allied victory, far from it, but, in her words, because it determined that the war would go on.
Meaning
it ended the war of movement. The chance for a swift knockout blow was gone for both sides. The armies dug in. Trenches were carved across northern France. The long, static, horrific slaughter of trench warfare began. The dream of a short war died on the Marne.
That shift from movement to stalemate really is the defining tragedy that shapes the rest of the war and maybe the century. Okay, let's pull back a bit and try to integrate some of the key lessons Tuchman draws from this catastrophic month. Lessons that feel, well, surprisingly relevant even today.
I think the primary lesson, the one that hits you hardest, is about the failure of rigid planning.
Right. The Schlieffen Plan, Plan of Seven.
Exactly. These incredibly elaborate, detailed blueprints, they were just spectacular failures because they were totally disconnected from, you know, inherent reality. Friction, fog of war, unexpected enemy actions, new technology. The plans couldn't cope.
And Tuckman really nails that failure, doesn't she, when she talks about the relentless pace of mobilization. She writes, "The deadliest enemy of war is haste. That sheer speed, driven by the timetables, it prevented any chance for second thoughts, for political wisdom to kick in."
Precisely. And that's a timeless warning, isn't it, for any large organization, really? Business, government. You see the danger of overly rigid waterfall-style project planning that doesn't build in flexibility or allow for, you know, human judgment to override the process when things inevitably go sideways.
Yeah, absolutely. What's another key theme?
I think the second powerful lesson is about the unintended consequences of rational preparation. This one is fascinating.
How so?
Well, look at each nation's actions before the war in isolation. Building big navies, designing intricate railway schedules for mobilization, forming alliances. From their own individual perspective, each step probably seemed rational, defensive, prudent.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
But Tuckman shows how, when all these individually rational preparations interacted, when they were combined, they created this enormous, complex, interconnected system that was incredibly prone to collective catastrophic failure. One spark, and the whole thing went up.
It's the ultimate example of systemic risk, isn't it? You see echoes of that today everywhere. Global finance, supply chains, maybe even complex algorithms driving decisions faster than humans can control them.
Totally. And it connects to another powerful quote from Tuckman where she reflects, "The terrible thing about this war is that it was unnecessary."
Unnecessary. That's devastating.
It is. Because she's arguing it wasn't some inevitable clash of forces. It was the result of specific, flawed human choices and system designs that could have perhaps been different. That makes the tragedy even deeper because it feels avoidable.
And you mentioned individuals earlier. That's another key theme, right? The role of individual personality in crisis.
Absolutely. The book is full of these sharp contrasts. Think about Moltke, the German commander, intelligent perhaps, but indecisive, buckling under the immense pressure, losing control.
Compared to Joffre.
Exactly. Compared to Joffre on the French side, with his famous calm, his ability to filter information and make a clear, decisive call, launching the Marne counterattack even when things look bleakest. Tuckman really drives home that history isn't just about abstract forces. It truly results from the decisions, the strengths, the weaknesses of specific individuals under unbearable stress.
Joffre's steadiness under fire is almost a mini case study in crisis leadership itself, isn't it? His ability to just maintain focus, not panic, and spot that critical opportunity, Kluck's exposed flank, was probably more valuable at that moment than any amount of theoretical brilliance.
I agree. It highlights the importance of temperament in leadership, not just intellect.
And maybe it connects back to planning, too. The Schlieffen Plan is this ultimate cautionary tale against rigid, top-down strategies. But the Battle of the Marne, especially Gallieni using the taxis on the spot, feels like a case study in empowering adaptive leadership further down the chain.
That's a great point. You see that adaptability not just in Joffre recognizing the strategic shift, but Gallieni in Paris making that tactical decision, get the taxes. They weren't waiting for the entire grand plan to be rewritten from HQ. They saw an opportunity created by the plan's failure, and they acted decisively. That local initiative, that flexibility, arguably saved Paris.
Okay, so we've covered the plans, the people, the key battle, the themes. Let's talk about some of those memorable lines. Tuckman's prose is just so quotable.
It really is. She had such a gift for phrasing. We've already mentioned a couple, like, "The deadliest enemy of war is haste," which perfectly captures how those mobilization schedules just crushed diplomacy.
And the devastating one. "The terrible thing about this war is that it was unnecessary," highlighting that sense of avoidable tragedy driven by human choices.
Then there's her assessment of the Marne. It was decisive because it determined that the war would go on. Such a chilling way to frame a victory. It didn't end the war. It just locked everyone into 4 more years of attrition.
Yeah, that one really sticks with you. And we can't forget that beautiful opening line describing the 1910 funeral. "So gorgeous was the spectacle that the sun, for once, acknowledged the rival brilliance of earthly potentates." It just perfectly captures the grandeur and the unawareness of that doomed pre-war world.
It sets the stage perfectly. Her writing is full of lines like that, which make the history so vivid.
Okay, let's try to bring this home. Thinking about real-life applications today, What can we take away from the Guns of August in a practical sense?
Well, one clear takeaway is about leadership in crisis. We talked about Joffre's imperturbability. For anyone in a leadership role today facing intense pressure, a business crisis, a public emergency, that ability to maintain focus, filter noise, and avoid panic is often more critical than having the perfect technical solution immediately. Temperament matters hugely.
That makes sense. And the planning aspect.
The Schlieffen Plan is, as you said, the ultimate cautionary tale against rigid waterfall project planning. Any organization today needs to build in strategic flexibility. You need mechanisms for feedback, for adapting when the initial assumptions prove wrong, empowering people closer to the front line like Galliani at the Marne to make informed tactical adjustments is crucial. You can't rely on a monolithic plan working perfectly.
So less top-down rigidity, more adaptability and distributed decision-making.
Exactly. And related to that is communication and coordination. Tuchman highlights the breakdown in communication between Moltke's headquarters and his field commanders like Kluck. That disconnect had disastrous consequences. Mm-hmm. It's a timeless challenge, right? Yeah. Coordinating complex operations, especially with distributed teams or remote work today, you need clear channels, shared understanding, and robust ways to know what's actually happening on the ground. Miscommunication in complex systems can be fatal.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up, what's the single most powerful lesson or thought you take away from Tuchman's work here?
That's tough. There are so many. But I think for me, it's her fundamental revelation that these enormous catastrophes, they often aren't the result of some single grand act of evil or a villain pulling the strings.
Right.
Instead, they're usually an accumulation, a buildup of smaller, often understandable human failings, miscommunications, flawed assumptions, bureaucratic inertia, anxieties, pride. It's a tragedy born from a cascade of flawed logic within a complex system that makes it both more terrifying and perhaps more relatable.
That's a really profound point. It wasn't necessarily malice, but a series of miscalculations and system failures with human beings caught inside. For me, I think the most valuable, enduring insight is that timeless warning against surrendering our human judgment completely to an impersonal system.
Whether that system is a military timetable.
Exactly. Or a political ideology, or maybe today a complex algorithm we don't fully understand. Tuchman reminds us, I think, of the absolute necessity for human wisdom, for critical thinking, for ethical consideration to constantly temper and guide these powerful systems we create. We can't just let the machine run itself.
Well said. The need for human judgment remains paramount.
A powerful thought indeed to leave you with. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.